Welcome to Box Office Battle, where we take bombs, forgotten classics, and underappreciated movies and pit them against each other for the right to get on Mount Valhalla. I'm Biggs.
I'm the Beard.
I'm Zach.
I'm so proud. Is that 2 weeks in a row you got all three?
It is, yeah.
Good job. Good show.
I am doing a film written and directed by Todd Haynes called Velvet Goldmine.
I am doing the 2003 movie Big Fish.
Okay, what's the common theme here?
Ewan McGregor. So, Velvet Goldmine, written and directed by Todd Haynes, takes place... It sort of bridges multiple timelines, but the bulk of it takes place in 1984 Britain and 70s Britain during the glam rock explosion. And essentially, we're following a young reporter by the name of Arthur Stewart, is played by Christian Bale, who is asked to do a story about the 10-year anniversary of a hoax pulled by glam rock superstar Brian Slade, where he pretended to be assassinated at one of his concerts, and that set forth the events that led to the end of his career. This film is structured in a way that's incredibly reminiscent of Citizen Kane, and it adds a cool element to the storytelling, whereas Christian Bale is interviewing these various subjects who were part of Slade's life. We get vignettes and a little bit of the backstory filling you in on this evolution of this kid from England becoming a megastar and his subsequent downfall. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers plays Slade.
And, another crossover in this movie.
Yeah, damn right. Shout out to you, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Good work on the Tudors. And Ewan McGregor plays Kurt Wilde, an American who is essentially Iggy Pop and Lou Reed. Brian Slade is very much David Bowie. And there are a lot of other figures who are clearly stand-ins or composites of multiple real glam rock figures. There are no David Bowie songs in the soundtrack because David Bowie did not like that the script didn't place the character who's sort of like him in a 100% positive light at all times. He did not like that.
Didn't like that they never put him in a space suit.
Oh, they get spacey in this movie. You don't got to worry about that.
This is Bowie back to Bowie. I hear you loud and clear, man. Ooh, yeah, man.
But this
That's movie- for you, Eric Tooten.
This movie is not shy about showing off the flaws of the Bowie stand-in, essentially. Although he does have a little bit of various other figures in him as well. So basically, Arthur Stewart is... Christian Bale is tracking down these stories, trying to piece together what happened after Brian Slade's career fell apart. And we learn that Stewart was a huge glam rock fan when he was a teenager. He was at a lot of the shows, so we see him early on in the film. He was very much a part of that world, even if he wasn't one of the figures of that world, like Brian Slade and Kurt Wilde, the Rhys-Meyers and Ewan McGregor characters. We also learn that Brian Slade, he wants his music to bring about a sexual revolution. He's bisexual. This is a movie that a lot of its themes deal with sexuality and how it relates to pop music, how it relates to people in society's understanding. And Todd Haynes is a openly gay man, so it's no surprise that he makes that a big theme, but it's done very well. Christian Bale's character is a gay man, and we see a lot of him growing up loving glam rock and coming, trying to accept who he is. Kurt Wilde, the Ewan McGregor character, is also a gay man. And so we see a lot of trysts between Kurt Wilde and Brian Slade tearing up Slade's marriage. Christian Bale has a little bit of time with Ewan McGregor.
Does it kind of play around with the Mick Jagger, Bowie kind of legend?
Yes, very much so.
That's what I thought of immediately.
Very much so. It's just the thing that makes this film most interesting is how it so perfectly captures a world in a way that feels almost as if it's a biopic of things that actually happened, because it is presented in a very biopic fashion where you are essentially asked to treat this Brian Slade as if he was a real rock star in our history. It also, in a lot of places,
kind of like Eddie and the Cruisers in that way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it also, there are a lot of moments where it feels like a documentary because there's a narration aspect throughout different parts of the movie, giving some of the exposition and backstory that we don't see on screen. And so it begins to feel like a documentary, and then other parts, it feels like a coming of age movie. It's a really interesting story told in an interesting way with just incredible lights out performances. Like, if nothing else, this movie's worth watching for the amazing performances by Christian Bale, Ewan McGregor, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Those three fucking bring it in this movie.
All right, so I did the 2003 movie Big Fish, directed by Tim Burton. This movie is, you almost forget it's a Tim Burton movie, which is a definite plus, I feel.
It definitely is for me, because I'm going to be honest, there's already a minus with the Tim Burton in your category.
Just the only thing that really like pops out is some of the character actors they use in this. I mean, they have Helena Bonham Carter, which is a plus, I understand.
Yes, very much so.
And a couple other small characters. The little Oompa Loompa from that movie, which I don't shall know. Not be named.
I've never watched it fully. I don't like the idea of Willy Wonka as a child molester. This ruins my childhood a little bit.
But this one is a really good character study. Basically, this film is about a relationship between a man who's getting married and his father. We start out in the movie with a great scene in the middle where he's telling a story at an event where he was out fishing. There's this big fish the day of the son's birth. He's out fishing for this. People have tried all over the state trying to catch this fish, and he decides to use a rather different approach and uses his wedding ring as bait. It's basically a metaphor for catching his wife. There's a great scene where he's leaving town, and he's not announced that he's leaving town yet, but there's this giant that's been like dealing people's sheep, terrorizing the village. And so Ewan McGregor decides to go and talk to this giant and find out what's going on. He basically convinces the giant to leave, but only on the condition that Ewan McGregor leaves with him, because he's too big for this town. Because of this scene where Albert Finney's telling the story about catching the big fish with the wedding ring, the son's basically listened to all his stories. He's heard every story that he's had throughout his childhood and growing up. He really wants to know who this person that supposedly his father is, but his father, he feels his father's not been honest with him. And so he basically grows apart. His father is dying a little bit into the movie. So he comes back and is trying to reconcile with his father. It's really great how they tell the story. And then at his deathbed, he's trying to tell him that everything he's told him has been true. You know, he's met all these great people. He's met a giant. He's worked in the circus for a while. Danny DeVito has a great role as the leader of the circus, introduces him to his future wife, becomes an indentured servant for the circus. Every month that he works for him, Danny DeVito tells him another fact about this girl that he met he's absolutely in love with.
Does Danny DeVito eat raw fish?
No, raw bunnies.
Wow.
It turns out...
Even grosser than the penguin.
Turns out he's a werewolf.
Oh.
Supposedly. Wow. There's a scene where he ends up playing fetch with him as a Danny DeVito werewolf. He comes out. Of course, you see the entire backside nude of Danny DeVito. Not a pretty scene. So when he's leaving with the giant, he stumbles upon this little town that has no streets in it. Like, all this where the streets would be is just like this really soft grass. This little girl comes up and steals his shoes, throws him up on a wire. But it's a really sweet little town. Everybody knows each other. It's really friendly. And he leaves... comes back later and the town is just a ghost town. It's all run down. The people have left. Steve Buscemi is one of the characters in there. He met Steve Buscemi just before he came back, and he had left town and actually like traveled the world, but he's done some shit. He actually is going to a bank that Steve Buscemi is robbing. So, you know, this town is in trouble, and he ends up buying the entire town, lets all the residents still live there, and actually build it back up to what it was. The son decides to actually research and is finding these people in the story. So he finds out that there's really a lot of truth to what he's telling. He's just embellishing it as a fish story, basically. Basically, he's dying, but he's turned into a fish as a metaphor. And it's just a great ending.
So the first thing I'm going to lead off with is just the sheer star power. I really cannot emphasize enough how good the performances are in this movie. They are star-making for anybody in that cast. Anybody who plays those roles as well as they did deserves to be a superstar. There's also great performances by Toni Collette as Brian Slade's wife and later ex-wife, and Eddie Izzard as Brian Slade's creepy manager. And really, more than anything else, this is a character story. To buy into this movie, you have to care about some of the characters and be fascinated by the characters you're supposed to be fascinated by. And that doesn't work without these performances. And also, the well-deserved Oscar nomination for the costume design, which really adds another level of verisimilitude to this film. I obviously was not around for the glam rock era, but I'm familiar with the music, I'm familiar with the aesthetic and its place in history, and this, more than anything else I've seen about that era in music and those people, made me feel what it was like to be there and really understand that moment in history for the people to whom it was important to.
Now, you're talking about some star power. Big Fish had some great star power. I mean, I had already mentioned Danny DeVito and Carl the Giant. We also had Jessica Lange put a great performance in this. He plays Albert Finney's wife in the later years.
Jessica Lange's a he? Damn, he's a good actor.
Missy Pyle is in it. She plays one of the town residents. Benson makes an appearance.
Benson! You know Benson, right? He was on Sports Night.
I love Sports Night.
Yeah.
I'm just mostly upset you're leaving out the anchor of the cast.
The anchor?
Billy Crudup. As the adult son of Albert Finney.
I don't recognize him in anything
else. I'm a golden god!
Yeah, from Almost Famous. That's an important one because Almost Famous is one of my favorite movies.
So, I mean, the performance they put are really touching in this movie. So, what you got for star power? We got it too.
You know, I got to say, I'm really happy you said Almost Famous is one of your favorite movies for two reasons. One is it's one of my favorite movies. The second is, without even realizing that, I was gonna bring this up anyway. This movie is very much the Almost Famous for its genre. It's the coming of age. It's the delving into the music and the sheer love of what's being shown on film. But it captures all the things specific to that time and that style in the way Almost Famous did. And just like the rock stars in Almost Famous are entertaining and can be you can care about them. You can feel almost any emotion that you are asked to feel with those characters. It's how you feel with this. More than anything, it captures and entrances your emotions. It puts you in the shoes of these people, and that comes from the storytelling, where little bits are coming out to you at a time, Citizen Kane style, where you get to truly understand this lifestyle and the toll it takes, and the type of people who are attracted to it, and then the type of people who are in turn attracted to rock gods.
Everything you just said is applicable to this, to Big Fish as well. I mean, there's a lot of the same grain. You get bits and pieces of the character Ewan McGregor and Albert Finney play. I mean, you just get small parts. When you first presented with them, there seemed like there's no way this can happen. He's obviously making this up. And then you realize further down the line that this is actually happened. You know, some of this like far out stuff. I mean, Helena Bonham Carter plays a quote unquote witch, but it turns out to be just a underappreciated person out in the wood that has been forgotten by time. The other thing that was really interesting about this movie is I had kind of written it off previous times I watched it as one of those afternoon filler movies, but there is so much small detail that they keep throwing at you that if you just tuning in, tuning out, you're not really getting the full big picture of the whole movie.
Brandon's been right so far in that a lot of the things I've said about Velvet Goldmine can be applied to Big Fish, because for two movies that are so wildly different in terms of what they're focusing on and their tone, there are some uncanny similarities. There's one thing Velvet Goldmine has in spades that Big Fish just can't measure up to. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I don't care if you're a man into ladies, a man into men, a lady into ladies, or a lady into men, there is something for everybody in terms of nudity in this movie.
What about a man into ladies, into transsexuals, back into men, and into ladies again?
Listen, I don't care if you're into interstellar demons. There's some naked shit in this movie for you.
So they got the David Bowie story.
Oh, right. Yeah. There are drugs everywhere. Alcohol everywhere. Sex everywhere. And I mean that literally. They cover some ground with their boning. And of course, rock and fucking roll. To really hammer this point home, if you've ever wanted to see in a dead-on Iggy Pop impression, Ewan McGregor just rip off his leather pants and dance about naked on stage, this is the movie for you.
I can honestly say I've never wanted to see that.
Not even a little bit? Not even kind of curious?
I'm a little bit now, but... I had never to this point thought, man, what would it be like if I had seen Ewan McGregor step out on stage, rip his other pants off?
Ruining your point, everybody walks out of that, out of Velvet Goldmine, a little gayer than they were when they walked in, including me.
One point I was going to bring up before I started into the intro on this, a lot of the movies I've done in the past have been 80s big name movies that have been kind of dropped off. So I really wanted to get away from that. I didn't want to be that guy. Sort of like Zach's pot movie announcement.
It was How High, I think.
You and voted then leaves for it. Grass. Yeah.
So this was my first step away from that genre, and I'm kind of happy on that. The real part that I really took away from Big Fish is it is really touching father-son dialogue. You can see there's a lot of true emotion going back and forth between the father and the son. You can really see the son's point of view where he's hurt everything his father. I mean, everybody knows somebody that they've heard every story that they've had to tell and not really 100% sure that any of that is actually true, or, you know, you realize that there's probably some nugget of truth in there, but you know that there are guys talking. And so, you know, there's a lot of real truth in this movie.
So I really only have one last thing to say, because I've built my movie up and I could build it up more if I wanted. I could talk about the positive attributes of this movie all day. But sometimes I know that in box office battle, the best tactic is to cut your opponent's legs out from under them. And there's one thing about Big Fish that you can't defend, because it is the first on-screen appearance of an actress by the name of Destiny May Cyrus, who you may know better as Miley Cyrus. That's right. Her career was launched by Big Fish.
Wow.
Ouch.
I'm not going to lie. That's a fucking megaton bomb, dude.
She was the little girl running around in Shoe Town.
Yeah, she was the one that stole the shoes. Damn you. Damn you to hell.
I'm not going to lie. You better come up with a defense for that, dude.
She was only on the screen for 30 seconds.
She's a little more than that.
Not a whole lot. You really wanted to punch that little girl. You did really want to punch that little girl.
I didn't at the time, but I mean, you know what? I better stop. I'm not. Can you cut that out, please? Please cut that out.
It's pretty good. You got him to say something he shouldn't have said.
I didn't say it. I stopped myself short.
You said enough.
That's not getting cut, is it?
Of course it's not.
God damn. Okay. Well, I guess the last thing I can say is the music in Velvet Goldmine is a real treat. It is songs from the era, with a couple exceptions. Well, first of all, it's songs from the era played by, like, Radiohead plays one of the bands in the movie. There's a bunch of real life bands playing these fictional bands, but they're playing real glam rock songs of the era. But they record them live, so they have a cool different feel to it. I mean, essentially they're covers, but they sound great. The only thing is they also write original songs for Brian Slade's character, and that's where it gets interesting. The songs feel as if they came from that era. They really do have the glam rock feel, and part of that is from the delivery of Jonathan Rhys Meyers, who apparently can fucking belt it. Who knew?
I know we say a lot of the time that this is a tough decision. And it is kind of tough because you guys are hitting me on two fronts that are near and dear to me. Zach, you're bringing up something on rock and roll, which I love. Like, when it's done terribly, it's done terribly. And I don't want to be anywhere near it, but it sounds like they got a lot of stuff right. It really intrigues me when you bring up that Radiohead did a song for this. That really intrigues me, hearing them with glam rock. I really like David Bowie. And even if he bowed out, it tells me there's probably some stuff a little too close that he didn't like, which is, you know, sometimes you kind of have to cut a little closer than the artist wants, because the artist is used to, like, making their vision. They're not always thrilled with somebody else making the vision for them. So I can tell that this movie might be one that's near and dear to my heart. Brandon, you're bringing up something like a father-son, strong relationship. relationship story. That's something that always appeals to me. I love movies where they have a strong story between like a parent and their child. I even liked it when I was a child. Now that I'm a father, those things really resonate. And you bring up a really strong cast too, which I enjoy. Steve Buscemi, Danny DeVito. These are guys that I'm always willing to follow them anywhere. So I will be saying that I will see both of these movies for sure. However, there is an insurmountable mountain that's been placed in the way. And that mountain is not Miley Cyrus, but that was a good pull. It was entertaining. But no, I can deal with that. It's Tim Burton, man. I just can't in good conscience put out a victory for a Tim Burton who just a movie before put out the most awful reboot ever, Planet of the Apes. He needs to suffer. And, you know, Helen Bonham Carter sort of deserves what she gets, too, in this regard, because she's married to him and she was also in that horrible remake. So I'm sorry, Big Fish, forgotten.
So are we talking about how we feel about these movies?
Yeah. So I got to go incomplete on both, obviously. I will be watching them both. It's the principled stand for Tim Burton. I did really consider for a while going with your view, but in the end, I couldn't see any drawbacks to Zach's movie, so it was sort of hard when there's that Tim Burton thing looming. But give credit to Zach because he didn't pull out that gun and he totally could have. I've made my feelings clear time and time again about Tim Burton.
I'll start with Big Fish first. Honestly, there's a part of me that believes the wrong movie won. Like, I fucking love Big Fish. I love that movie. It is far and away my favorite Tim Burton movie, and it's not close. I adore that movie.
And this is things that I've heard from a lot of people telling me it's not really like a Tim Burton movie. Yeah, so
I have to give it an excellent. I love that movie. For Velvet Goldmine, here's the thing. Like 80% of the movie is great, but there are some flaws. And the thing is, there's way more positives to the movie than flaws. It's just the flaws are pretty big flaws. Namely in that the movie's way longer than it needs to be. It's totally self-indulgent for Todd Haynes. The narration does not work. That said, the stuff I talked about being good really is good. The performances are incredible. The music is a lot of fun. Some of the songs are better than others, especially the original stuff. But I mean, that's sort of what you expect when they're writing songs for a movie. The production design is gorgeous. It's perfect. The costumes are dead on, really interesting. There really is a lot of interesting meditation on various themes and ideas, including pop music and its place in history, sexuality, youth, how we chase these idols, the rise and fall of becoming a superstar, the steps in the road, the relationships with superstars. There's a lot of really interesting stuff focusing on the movie. It could have been a little tighter. So I have to give it probably a satisfactory minus, maybe a satisfactory. I'll go satisfactory minus just because there's not many flaws, but the flaws that are there are pretty big. That said, totally worth watching to get past it. It's a really, at the very least, even if you don't like it when you see it, it's very interesting to watch, and it'll be fun to be able to talk about it.
All right, I'm going to have to give incomplete on Velvet Goldmine. I had every intention of watching today. I had it in my queue for Netflix, but I was reading on it what it's about and what's in there, and you know, with all the nudity and everything.
Yeah,
and
like, it's not safe for children.
Oh, with the kids.
Yeah,
not safe around kids at all.
Tough summer movie around the Beardsley household.
Yeah. If it was a Saturday night where I'm watching by myself, yeah, that's the nice this thing, is something I would definitely
you two guys as music fans, you will love looking for the allusions to real things, the little clues, and trying to figure out characters and who they're based on in the real. There's a lot of fun stuff for music fans.
Is there any Freddie Mercury drops on there?
Not really. You can see a little bit of Freddie Mercury in the way Jonathan Rhys-Meyers does stuff, especially in earlier parts of his career. Sorry. He starts out basically as a flower child and slowly moves on to becoming David Bowie. So some of the interim bits, you can see like the way he struts around on stage is a little Freddie Mercury inspired, but there's nothing really getting into Queen.
Because of the Bowie tie-in.
The thing you gotta understand
glam rock, like Queen had a glam rock.
Oh, yeah. Too, so. But this movie, basically, it ends, the Brian Slade story ends in 1974, and it gets picked up in 84 by Stu. So anything that would have been after 1974 is not focused on at all in terms of its impact on glam music.
Was there any pods that come out they can't get out of? in this movie?
There is only one pod in the movie, and it's when David Bowie teams up with, or not David Bowie, Brian Slade, the David Bowie character, teams up with Kurt Wilde, the Iggy Pop, Lou Reed style character, to make their music video, which is very similar to the David Bowie Mick Jagger team up.
Oh my god, is that where they're dancing in the street?
They don't dance in the streets in this video. Instead, they're riding around in like a little space pod. It's pretty great. But dude, it doesn't have a cover, so it's not just in space. They're just sort of flying around.
You just reconvinced me that the right movie.
Some of these scenes in this movie are just straight up music videos for Brian Slade songs. It's really fun. Like 3 minutes of just showing his music video. It's a good time.
Well, how would you rate Big Fish, Brandon?
Big Fish, I'm going to have to give an excellent, because I mean, there is not really much that really distracts from this movie. I mean, there's a great stories that go on in this movie.
It's visually stunning.
It is a great movie. That being said, there is the one drawback is there is a couple little Tim Burton-isms where they have dark sets that are brightly lit that have parts that pop. I mean, it totally looks like the Joker scene in Batman where like there's one really colorful centerpiece and then it's really dark around
the
outside.
You know, I will say that I don't hate that. Like, it is Tim Burton's look and I don't hate
it. No, I'm just saying that's...
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, it's just that he had this point in his career that I feel like continued that...
That's all he can do.
It's just that he does chose to do a lot of bad movies and continue to... The style is fine. I have nothing against the style.
I think the style...
It works for his older movies.
I think the style is a problem when he relies too heavy on it. Because he did pick a lot of bad movies to do, but he also made those bad movies worse.
It seems like Tim Burton's problem is when he is taking material that's already been done.
There's nobody left to tell him no, either. Nobody left to tell him no.
And that's really the Burton problem to me. Which is why I will give Big Fish a chance. I swore up and down to another friend of mine, whose name escapes me at the moment, that I would someday watch it, and I will. I've heard enough from everybody that like, no, I don't like Tim Burton, but this is a good movie. So that's enough to convince me. And what you said really did convince me I should watch it. But that being said, with Tim Burton, it is him rebooting things, not just Planet of the Apes, but
but Alice in Wonderland,
Sleepy Hollow, was
Charlie
terrible.
And the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, it's all this stuff. When he doesn't have an original idea or he's not working off an original screenplay, it's a problem 10 out of 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
Even like Frankenweenie, I saw part of that because the kids were watching it. And it's just like, ugh.
And it doesn't.
He's basically just taking an old short he did and he's fleshing it out.
But it doesn't really have that style of stuff like the core line, the Frankenweenie, Sleepy Hollow, where it's that macabre kind of look to things.
Yeah, that playful darkness.
Yeah.
Especially, and he really has gotten to a point in his career where he just leaned, much like Zack Snyder needed to learn to lay off slow-mo a little bit. He needs to learn to just, like, the Tim Burton style works best as spice in a movie, like bringing an interesting flair to it.
Let's be honest. I'm going to bring up a movie you're going to laugh at first when I say it, but then think about it. Like Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh, yeah. No, you're totally right.
So it's got that darkness around it, but everything is colorful in the inside, and it just adds like character to the film. Like the Large Marge part is the best part of that movie, and it's because it's this like inexplicable dark thing that like drives humor.
Yeah.
And it had a point when it was dark, and that's kind of that. Yeah. If there is a problem with his aesthetic, it's that it doesn't have a point anymore. It's just his look now. But that's kind of territory that like Wes Anderson, some people have accused him of leaning too heavy on his style. But I would say his style's never been a problem because his style serves his movies.
Yes, but you do, much like Tim Burton has sort of become a parody of Tim Burton, I will worry that one of these times is going to be the time Wes Anderson has become a parody of
but
himself.
I will say that most recent one, the Grand Budapest Hotel, is phenomenal.
Really
I know
good.
We don't normally shill for other movies on this podcast, but we're on a little short. What the hell? Fucking see that movie. Not only is it like visually stunning, the
Ray
story
Fiennes
is
so funny,
and it really does break from character with a lot of stuff with Wes Anderson. Like things
way
don't
more
all,
cursing
things
than usual, for
and
Wes
things
Anderson
don't all
movie.
End up happy.
Mm-mm.
Wes Anderson always has this like line of melancholy, but at the end it sort of works out. Grand Budapest, there's shit that doesn't work out. Like this plane doesn't work out, but it's still a fun movie. You know,
very much so. So we talked about three really good movies that are worth seeing today. Good work, guys.
Yeah.
fill those seats so we don't have to.
We had a good life.
Jack the Ripper. Middle name T, I guess you could take it like that. Jack T. Ripper.
Yeah, if his middle name is The.
Yeah.
At least in his title, that would be the middle initial. So Jack T. Ripper.
T. Ripper. Jack Tripper from Three's Company.
Done and done, dude.
It's over.
That's unfucking believable. You solved the mystery.
Dude, give me my fucking money.
Yeah, no, I agree. Give
somebody,
him his money.
Give him his fucking money. Give me my prize money for that, because I put that shit together, folks.
It's real. Recognize.
Yeah, John Ritter, woman murderer.
Yeah, dead now, cannot be brought to justice.
Dude, nobody's ever going to know the truth.
Real Roulette with Zach and Biggs.
She covers her body with chicken fat, completely
strips
naked.
Down. Yep.
Goes running through the camp, and every girl tries to stop her.
But they can't.
But they can't because it's chicken fat.
She slips through them. No, it has been established she's been trying to get at the other black girl.
It doesn't even look like they're even touching
no,
her.
No,
like, it's the worst acting
she's,
ever.
No. I just like to imagine that she's the Barry Sanders of this prison camp. Like, when she turns it on, ain't nobody can stop her.
Shooting the shit show.
Who would win between Heisenberg and Godzilla? I came to the conclusion that Heisenberg would poison him with rice, and Joe was saying he'd find a way to chemically alter something in the sea and dissolve him or something.
There are two very unknown chemicals that, when combined, react to dissolve kaiju monsters.
Box office battle.
Would you say that the Necronomicon is a MacGuffin of sorts?
No, this is a single book, bound in few and flesh, inked in blood.
Brandon, are you familiar with what a MacGuffin is?
I have no idea. It's essentially an object, a person, or a place that doesn't really matter, but it's a put in place to drive the plot forward. Because see, I appreciate a film that knows how to use its literary device as well.
It is a literal literary device.
Montucky Sky.
What if we get Fassbender as like the sadistic ruler of this dystopian future?
Yes.
So we have the already sick and twisted Fassbender as the king, and he's getting whispers from someone even more sadistic and Willem Dafoe.
Jesus is Robocop. This is no longer the driving force of this movie.
Uh-huh.
Not safe for network.